Australia's military history is more than just a collection of dates and the locations of war-ravaged battlefields. It is the stories of service and sacrifice of those who have answered the call of their country of birth or adoption and the enduring legacy they have created. Join me as we look into one of those stories. I'm your host, Ross Manuel, and welcome to I Was Only Doing My Job, Australia's Military History, a Doc Network podcast. Now let's get started. G'day friends and welcome to episode 50 of the podcast, and my apologies in the delay. I actually lost my voice about 4 weeks ago when this episode was actually supposed to come out, and you can probably still tell I've got the residuals of that. I've only just getting my voice back. But to celebrate this milestone, I'm also very happy to announce that I Was Only Doing My Job, an Australian military history podcast, has been ranked 33rd on Feedspot's top 50 military history podcast list. Now that is their global ranking list. This is also alongside our fourth placing on the Australian Military History Podcast chart, and this is directly result of the amazing support from each and every one of you, and for that, I thank you all. In other news, this and the next three new episodes will be coinciding with History Talk's Shipwreck Summer. This idea was concocted by a friend of the podcast, Melissa Ratliff of God's Favourites, a history podcast. And as always, you can continue with the conversation over on our social channels and join the Armored Emu Brigade community we have over on Discord. As always, links to everything are on our website and in the show notes. But let's get underway with this week's episode. Robert Ian Davies was born on the 13th of November 1923 in Greenwich, Sydney. He and his sister Pauline were the only children born to Australian-born clerk Thomas Robert Davies and his English wife Mabel Irene. Known as Bob to his friends and family, he was considered, quote, a friendly, fresh-faced lad, unquote. And in 1927, after he completed his early schooling at the North Sydney Boys High School, at the tender age of 14, he joined 15 other 13 and 14-year-old boys at the Victoria Barracks in Melbourne to attend the Royal Australian Naval College at its temporarily relocated home of the Flinders Naval Depot, the home of HMAS Cerberus, the Royal Australian Navy's primary training facility for naval recruits. This shift was due to the slashing of defence budgets brought on by the Great Depression. While at the Naval Depot, he joined eight other cadets of Cook class. The remainder would join Phillip class. These boys were the successful applicants of nearly 500 prospective candidates. Each class year was named after a famed naval personality. Cook was after Captain James Cook of HMS Endeavour, Phillip after Admiral Arthur Phillip, the first governor of the colony of New South Wales, Jarvis after Admiral John Jarvis, and Flinders after famed navigator Matthew Flinders. This tradition continues to this day, though in 2014, the classes were renamed Clarkson after Vice Admiral William Clarkson, co-founder of the Royal Australian Navy, Moran after Commander William Moran, who actually served with Robert Davies, Rankin after Lieutenant Commander Robert Rankin, commanding officer of HMAS Yarra during the Second World War, and Waller, named after Captain Hector MacDonald Laws Waller of the Scrap Island Flotilla, HMAS Perth, and episode 33 of the podcast. Though I don't claim that's the reason. The Naval College would stay at the depot until 1958, but it would return to HMAS Creswell in Jarvis Bay, named after Admiral Jarvis. While at the college, he contributed to the Royal Australian Naval College magazine and penned the following poem. Quote, "This world of ours is small enough, but circumstances state, the queerest of all freaks at large are first year small and great. Now when the breakfast pipes do blow, quite queer it is to see, the first year's lean and hungry look transform to one of glee. If through this world at large you roam, you never there will see a stranger yet more hungry crowd than the germs at FND." Unquote. Life at the FND, as Davies referred to the Flinders Naval Depot, involved high school studies intermixed with naval training, such as parade, drill, seamanship and engineering, with Davies showing particular aptitude for navigation. Weekends were occupied by sport, something that he also excelled in. He played hockey, tennis, athletics and rugby union, and would go on to gain his colours for athletics and for rugby, a game he also showed, quote, strong, determined running, unquote, while also serving as team captain. Academically, according to fellow classmate and future Rear Admiral Guy Griffiths, he, quote, shone academically, unquote. While at the Naval College, he also routinely contributed to the RNAC magazine, writing mainly sports reports and contributing photos and poems. One of the interesting peculiarities of attending the Flinders Naval Depot for Davies and the other cadets was learning the terminology. Floors became decks, walls became bulkheads, and beds became bunks. Another interesting fact about the depot that I've picked up in my travels is that walking on the grass there is considered going overboard, and anecdotally is afforded the same man overboard call that occurs aboard ships, but I digress. On the 12th of December, 1940, Davies and the 15 soon-to-be graduates attended a dinner in their honour at the depot's wardroom, and were given beer for the first time, officially. Traditionally, the Governor General would have been the reviewing officer for their passing out parade, but as Australia was involved in the Second World War at this point, and the Governor General was otherwise occupied, the salute was received by the first naval member, Admiral Sir Ragnar Colvin. Davies would graduate near the top of his class and be promoted to midshipman on the 1st of January 1941. All of these newly minted midshipmen were destined for the Royal Australian Navy's two county-class heavy cruisers, HMAS Australia 2 and HMAS Canberra 1. Canberra at the time was the flagship, but though by the end of the Second World War, both ships would hold that pennant. The first five midshipmen alphabetically, Davies included, were destined to join the complement of Australia, who at the time was in English waters, while the remainder would be posted to Canberra. He and along with the other four midshipmen were placed under the charge of Royal Australian Navy Commander Alvord Rosenthal, who would board the refrigerated cargo vessel Karamea and arriving in Clyde, Scotland on the 16th of February. The following day, the midshipmen boarded the train bound for Australia House in London to report in, only to find that their berth had already slipped its moorings. For the rest of the month, while the Admiralty determined what to do with these now orphaned midshipmen, Davies and the others were allowed to go sightseeing and experience the effects of the German Blitz on the London people, while being billeted to the shore installation HMS Victory at the Portsmouth Dockyard until the early March, when Davies and the others were informed that they were going to be posted to the venerable First World War renowned class battlecruiser HMS Repulse. They reported aboard on the 5th of March 1941 at the rank of substantive midshipman. Repulse was a 32,000-ton battlecruiser with six 15-inch guns, between 3 and 10 inches of armour protection, and an impressive speed of 32 knots with a crew of over 1,300 officers and men. This is compared to the heaviest ships in the Royal Australian Naval Fleet at the time, which were the sister heavy cruisers Australia and Canberra, at 9,000 tons apiece, 8 8-inch guns, and between 1.5 and 4.5 inches of armour. They were slightly slower at 31.5 knots and had a small crew of 815. This was a marked difference and something that could not have been able to be done solely within the Royal Australian Navy. Accommodations on a warship, even one as majestic and large as the Repulse, were cramped, but the crew made it livable as the five midshipmen learned and applied their trade as sailors in the time of war. The battlecruiser was routinely out at sea escorting convoys around the Atlantic, while also on the futile search for German surface vessels, which allowed the midshipmen to learn and equip themselves. On the 22nd of May, 1941, Repulse set out from Clyde to escort WS-8B, a fast troop convoy bound for the Indian Ocean, though it had to leave the convoy to its fate as Repulse was ordered to steam north to join the fleet being formed around battleship HMS Prince of Wales and the battlecruiser HMS Hood, pursuing the feared German flagship, the pocket battleship Bismarck. They would join the remainder of the home fleet around the battleship HMS King George V, the aircraft carrier HMS Victorious, four cruisers and seven destroyers. While still en route, the fleet would receive the devastating news that the pride of the Royal Navy, the Hood, had been sunk and Bismarck was still at large. Despite the cry to avenge the Hood running rampant throughout the Atlantic and Pacific, Repulse would have no further role. Due to the demands of running the ship at such a high rate of speed in order to close the distance between WS-8B and the rest of the home fleet, Repulse ran low on fuel and had to make port in Conception Bay, Newfoundland. In doing so, they would hear the news that Bismarck had been sunk at the hands of HMS King George V and HMS Rodney. As there was an Australian officer serving aboard King George V at the time, I'll cover the sinking of the Bismarck at a later date. Repulse put to sea once more to hunt for Bismarck's escort, the Prince Eugen, before returning to port at Halifax, Nova Scotia for repairs. In July, Repulse was in port in Rosyth, undergoing refit, and in doing so, upgraded its close-range anti-aircraft weapons, mainly the installation of additional 20mm Oricon anti-aircraft guns. These guns would prove integral to Davies' military career, as he would be declared by the commanding officer of Repulse, Captain William Tennant, as, quote, an outstanding officer of quarters of close-range guns, unquote. Now, I had to speak to a number of sailors I knew to translate this into English, and as I couldn't find an actual period explanation, so my apologies if this isn't entirely accurate, but essentially, the quarters are the rear of the ship, and as officer of quarters, Davies was the officer responsible for the safety and efficiency of the equipment and stores in his assigned area and the drill and instruction of officers and sailors stationed there on the close-range guns, namely those additional 20mm Oricon guns. Following this refit, Repulse was once again on convoy duty, escorting a convoy once again bound for the Indian Ocean in August 1941. Despite there being a state of global war, this mission did include the traditional honours to King Neptune to mark the ship crossing the equator. For the uninitiated, the so-called line-crossing ceremony is an initiation rite that commemorates a person's first crossing of the equator. In navies, it's traditionally a ceremony officiated by King Neptune himself, portrayed by a senior member of the ship's company, often a chief petty officer, in full costume, joined by his court, comprising of a cast of characters like Davy Jones, his wife Amphitrite, messengers, heralds, barbers, doctors, judges, police, and overseen by bears who are responsible for conducting the ceremonies. Honestly, I do recommend looking up videos of crossing the line ceremonies. These ceremonies historically comprise of hazing rituals, where polywogs, or new sailors, become shellbacks, usually after being covered in some form of food and then dunked into a bath of seawater, though some of these rituals have been dangerous and some sailors have been killed. These days, it's also a ceremony undertaken on cruise liners as light entertainment and is supposed to be heavily regulated to ensure that the new initiates to King Neptune's court do not sustain long-term injuries. Upon completion, the newly minted shellback is given a certificate and celebration takes place. It's supposed to be lighthearted fun and seen by many as a break in the normal routine. Though, after watching some of those videos and reading accounts of line crossing ceremonies on both warships and cruise liners, this landlubber will pay his respects to Imperium Neptuni Rex from the safety of shore. In October, Repulse was assigned to Task Force T and based out of Mombasa in British East Africa to hunt German surface raiders within the Indian Ocean while tensions started to rise in the Pacific. In previous episodes, I have mentioned that due to the state of war in Europe, Britain had stripped its overseas territories in the Pacific to reinforce positions in North Africa and England and left the defense of these colonial holdings to the Dominions, Australia, New Zealand, India, South Africa, and Canada. The core defensive position of this was Singapore. After the First World War, Australia re-evaluated its strategic position in the world and decided that Japan was its greatest threat, something that had been warned at by senior officers of the Australian military forces as early as 1905 following the Russo-Japanese War, but was only realised following the territorial carve-up of German Pacific positions following the armistices of the First World War. Britain at this time controlled large swaths of the Southwest Pacific and in response, in 1919, Singapore, which is located within the Strait of Malacca, connecting the Indian and Pacific Oceans, which is a strategically important sea route even to this day, was chosen as the site of a 54 square kilometre British naval base. This base was paid in part by the governments of Australia and New Zealand, who basically saw it as a defensive option for themselves. The core intent behind the various war plans that were collectively known as the Singapore Strategy was either to defeat Japan entirely or to simply dissuade Japanese aggression. Most of these involved a large British surface fleet supported by air power. Unfortunately, these plans were never truly updated as political situations changed, namely the gutting of the Royal Navy due to successive naval disarmament treaties, which reduced the number of available capital ships, the long-term effects of the Great Depression on defense budgets, and a prevailing anti-war sentiment amongst a lot of Western democracies meant that a lot of the upgrades and strengthening of Singapore in order to serve as a deterrent were never actually carried out. Initially, the plan called for a British Pacific Fleet to be stationed at Singapore comprising of battleships, battle cruisers, and aircraft carriers, supported by cruisers, destroyers, and submarines. As the Royal Navy lacked the resources to actually do this, the plan was altered to garrison Singapore sufficiently with air power and ground forces to hold the port facilities for an estimated 42 days, which was the minimum time a British fleet was required to be assembled and to steam from anchorages to go and relieve them. Time was then extended to 70 days, then 90 days, and then at the outbreak of the Second World War, it was now 180 days on the pretense that the fleet wasn't otherwise engaged. You know, with things like convoy duty and hunting German pocket battleships in the Atlantic. In October 1941, the decision was made that a force would be sent to deter Japanese aggression in the Southwest Pacific following their invasion of French-controlled Indochina, which is now modern-day Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. This force was not going to be the 20 capital ships, 10 cruisers, 40 destroyers, and 36 submarines, which was the initial plan outlined in the Singapore Strategy. Instead, it was going to be the battleship HMS Prince of Wales, the battlecruiser HMS Repulse, the aircraft carrier HMS Indomitable, and four destroyers. Conversely, in 1936, while in opposition, John Curtin prophetically stated that Japan would only likely attack Singapore when Britain was otherwise preoccupied with a war in Europe. The whole strategy also hinged on a gentleman's agreement that the US Navy would also send its Pacific Fleet, including eight battleships, to Singapore in the event of hostilities, which obviously required the US Navy to not otherwise be engaged with its own conflict or having most of its fleet at the bottom of Pearl Harbor. On the 4th of November 1941, Winston Churchill wrote to leader of the USSR, Joseph Stalin, to inform him that, quote, with the object of keeping Japan quiet, we are sending our latest battleship, Prince of Wales, which can catch and kill any Japanese ship into the Indian Ocean, unquote. On the 30th of November, Prince of Wales would rendezvous with Repulse. Indomitable, which ran aground off Jamaica while undergoing workup trials in the Caribbean, would not join them, so the remaining elements of the force, now designated Force Z, would steam in concert, and during the afternoon on the 2nd of December, would enter Singapore Harbour to much fanfare. For the next 2 days, the task force took on fuel and supplies and repaired minor damage, before orders were received that Repulse was destined for Darwin. While the prospect of returning to Australia was appreciated by Davies and his fellow midshipmen, that order was immediately rescinded on the 7th of December, and Repulse found itself once more in Singapore Harbour as it fell under attack from Japanese bombers. Soon, word would spread that Pearl Harbour had also been attacked, and Japanese troops were landing on the Malayan coastline. After receiving word of a Japanese convoy bound for Malaya, Force Z, comprising of Prince of Wales, Repulse, and the destroyers HMS Express, Electra, Tenedos, and HMAS Vampire, sailed from Singapore at 1710 on the 8th of December. The intention of Force Commander Admiral Sir Thomas Phillips, whose flag was aboard Prince of Wales, was to engage the Japanese naval forces near the eastern coast of Malaya and southern Thailand off Singora. For Davies and the rest of the complement, who had to endure being the bridesmaid to naval engagements to this point, according to Guy Griffiths, quote, "We're off to look for trouble, and I expect we shall find it," unquote. With Indomitable undergoing repairs after running aground, and the only other British carrier in the Indo-Pacific being the HMS Hermes, which was too slow to keep up, Force Z was sent to sea without any naval air protection. And as they proceeded out past the Changi Naval Station, they were informed that the Royal Air Force and Royal Australian Air Force squadrons on Malaya would not be able to offer air cover as they just lost the Kota Bharu airfield. Fortunately for Admiral Phillips, the cloud cover of the area was low enough that he hoped it would prevent Japanese reconnaissance aircraft from finding them, and they could use the element of surprise to attack the Japanese fleet, then withdraw. So much so, Force Z was actually overflown by two Japanese reconnaissance aircraft, but due to that cloud cover, their position was not reported. What Admiral Phillips hadn't counted on, however, was that the Japanese Second Fleet, operating as the covering force for the seaborne landings, had deployed submarines to act as early warning systems. At 1400 on the 9th of December, I-65, which was shadowing the British ships for 5 hours, radioed their positions to the 22nd Air Flotilla, based in the vicinity of Saigon, Indochina. Following this report, most of the Japanese fleet turned back to Cam Ra Bay in southern Vietnam. At the time, Japanese aircraft were in the process of loading bombs to attack Singapore Harbour, but they immediately switched to torpedoes. The bombers would not be ready until 1800 hours that day. The report also prompted the Japanese Second Fleet, Southern Malay Force's main body, to proceed south from Indochina to intercept Force Z. This fleet consisted of 2 battleships, 3 cruisers, and 8 destroyers. They would be also joined by 4 more cruisers of Cruiser Division 7, and 1 light cruiser and 4 destroyers of Destroyer Squadron 3.
Just before we continue, here's a word from one of our sponsors.
This episode was made possible thanks to the generous support from our backers, whose donations go towards paying for distribution and streaming costs, the digitization and procurement of records, as well as everything else that goes into making a podcast. And if you enjoy what we do here at I Was Only Doing My Job and want to support the podcast directly and get some sweet rewards in the process, follow the link in the episode description or visit our website to buy the podcast a coffee, either as a one-off or as an ongoing subscription. At the lowest tiers, you'll get episodes early and ad-free, and at higher tiers, you'll get a mention in the episode and even the ability to suggest future topics. For more information, check the link in the episode description or check out www.thedocnetwork.net. And now, let's get back to the show. At 1730, just a half hour before sunset, Force Z was spotted by 3 Aichi E-13A seaplanes, which had been catapulted off the Japanese cruisers, who were escorting the transports. These aircraft continued shadowing, and at about 1830, HMS Tenedos was detached to return to Singapore, because he was running low on fuel, with instructions to contact Rear Admiral Arthur Palliser, detailed to act as a liaison to the RAF in Malaya. Phillips was no longer going to attack Singora, although he did order his ships to change course at 1900 back towards it in an attempt to deceive the shadowing aircraft, then south towards Singapore at 2015 when darkness covered him. Phillips had received a report from Palliser of Japanese landings at Kuantan off the east coast of Malaya, halfway between Singapore and Kota Bharu. Phillips headed in their general direction without, however, signalling Palliser of his intentions, which would have revealed his position. Tenedos dutifully reported at 2000 hours, thereby preserving the secrecy of Force Z's position. That night, a Japanese seaplane mistakenly dropped a flare over the Japanese heavy cruiser Chokai, having mistaken her for the Prince of Wales. After this, the force of six cruisers and several destroyers turned away to the northeast. The flare was also seen by the British force, which feared that they had been identified and then turned away to the southeast. At this point, the forces were approximately 9 kilometres apart, but did not see each other. And the Japanese forces were not picked up on the radar of Prince of Wales. At 20:55, Admiral Phillips cancelled the whole operation, saying that they had lost the element of surprise and ordered the force to return to Singapore. At 03:15 hours, the force that was sighted by I-58 and gave its new position, indicating that the ships were heading south and appeared to be returning to Singapore. It had also reported that she had fired 5 torpedoes and missed, and then lost sight of the force 3 hours later. The British force did not see the torpedoes and never knew they'd been attacked. The report from I-58 reached the 22nd Air Flotilla headquarters at 03:40, and 10 bombers of the Genzen Air Group were dispatched at 0600 to conduct a sector search for the ships. This was followed at about 0700 by a striking force of some 88 aircraft, comprising of 27 bombers and 61 torpedo bombers, that also took off to search for the ships. At 0718, Prince of Wales launched one of its Supermarine Walrus reconnaissance aircraft and flew it towards Kuan Tan, saw nothing, reported back to Prince of Wales, and then flew to Singapore. HMS Express was then sent to investigate the area, but also found nothing. Unaware that the large force of Japanese land-based bombers were looking for the British force, but having not anticipated the detour to Kuan Tan, were searching much further south. At 1000 hours, Tenedos reported that he'd become under attack by Japanese aircraft, and the Japanese mistook the destroyer for a battleship and wasted ordnance without scoring a hit. 15 minutes later, the northernmost Japanese scout plane spotted Force Z and updated the fleet of their position. At 10:30, the fleet went into first degree of readiness or action stations, and the crew manned their battle stations. Midshipman Davies manned one of the 20mm Oerlikon guns on the aft quarter as fire distribution officer. He was responsible for pointing out which aircraft would be engaged by the gun crew. All he could do now was wait, as the range of the Oerlikon guns made them the last line of defense from attacking aircraft. By 1100 hours, Force Z's location had been confirmed, and the Japanese started to circle to attack. The Air Force quickly altered course to intercept the retreating British fleet, and as they had spread out to search the South China Sea for them, they arrived in small groups, and due to dwindling fuel reserves, they attacked on arrival instead of forming up to coordinate the attack. The first attack commenced at 11:13 as of 8 bombers concentrating their attack on Repulse. In response, Prince of Wales and Repulse opened up with their 5.25-inch and 4-inch anti-aircraft guns, respectively. Of the first 8 bombers, only one scored a hit, penetrating a seaplane hangar and exploded in the marine mess area, with no serious damage and few casualties. Repulse continued steaming at 25 knots and was still in the fight. Of these first 8 aircraft, 5 were damaged and 2 were forced to return to base. At 11:40, 17 Nell torpedo bombers commenced their attack. 8 zeroed in on Repulse while 9 attacked the flagship. 1 Nell was shot down and 3 more were damaged by Prince of Wales. Repulse's commanding officer, Captain William Tennant, skillfully maneuvered the ship to avoid incoming torpedoes. Prince of Wales, however, was not so lucky, as one lucky torpedo struck a fatal hit to her outer port propeller shaft housing, and as the shaft was rotating at full speed, it twisted, rupturing the glands that prevented seawater from entering the hull. In an instant, Prince of Wales took on 2,400 tons of water and slowed to a crawl and gave the ship an 11.5 degree list to port. Damage was also sustained to the power plant supplying electricity to the ship's aft 5.25-inch anti-aircraft guns, as well as to the pumps needed to drain the rapidly flooding rear compartments. Despite being still afloat, Prince of Wales was now dead in the water. The yard arm soon bore the signal flags not under command, which meant the ship could no longer be controlled or steered. Not long after the second wave, a third arrived, targeting Repulse, though due to Tennant's excellent seamanship, no hits were recorded. Captain Tennant then ordered Repulse to steam for Prince of Wales to render assistance. To his horror, when he queried Admiral Phillips what messages had been sent to Singapore about the attack, he found that none were made. He immediately radioed Singapore headquarters, quote, "enemy aircraft bombing Force Z," unquote, and gave their location. This was immediately forwarded to Air Vice Marshal Conway Pulford, who was Air Officer Commanding Far East, who ordered fighters launched immediately in an attempt to screen the battle group. At approximately 12:20, a fourth wave was picked up on radar, and Prince of Wales was struck by another 3 torpedoes. As his attack was taking place, Repulse was caught in a hammer and anvil attack, with torpedo bombers attacking from both port and starboard. While the torpedoes from the starboard attack were evaded, one from the port side managed to deliver a crippling blow. It was the 20th torpedo fired Repulse, and the first to find its target. While Repulse could still steam at 25 knots, its time was running out. As the fifth wave jumped on the two capital ships, swarming Repulse from all sides, there was nothing Tennant could do, and the ship was struck near the gun room, which was the midshipman accommodation, and in doing so jammed the rudder. It was only a matter of time. Three more torpedoes struck, two to the port side, one to starboard, as one sailor reported, quote, her steering gone, her great heart torn, unquote. These hits were fatal, and at 12:25, or a little over an hour after the first Japanese aircraft commenced their attack, Captain Tennant made the exceedingly difficult decision and ordered, quote, all hands on deck, prepare to abandon ship, God be with you, unquote. The crew of Repulse evacuated the ship in a very orderly fashion, despite the ship listing 30 degrees to port. All the while, control was assisted by the ship's broadcasting system, which remained operational except in some compartments down below aft, where orders had to be passed down by word of mouth. The air attacks continued as Repulse was sinking. Rear Admiral Griffiths recalled, quote, abandoned ship was ordered at 12:25 p.m. and was followed by an orderly but tense evacuation up ladders through hatches to the main deck level in the vicinity of the B turret. The mess deck seemed deserted and the ship's starboard side portholes were open. The increasing list of the ship to port still allowed one to clamber up the sloping deck and exit through a scuttle to the starboard side of the ship. Our fine old battlecruiser sank at 12:33 p.m. and I remember turning back to see the last of her bow disappear beneath the surface, unquote. It took a grand total of 7 minutes from the call to deck to the ship sinking. The sailors in the water cheered as their ship slipped beneath the waves. Of Repulse's complement of 1,309 men, 27 officers and 486 ratings were lost. One of those lost was midshipman Robert Ian Davies. He was 18 years old. He is commemorated on the Brighton War Memorial, panel 46 of column 3 of the Plymouth Naval Memorial, and is listed on the Roll of Honour of the Australian War Memorial in Canberra, where he's the only Australian killed aboard Repulse. Prince of Wales, despite being hobbled, was still in the fight, having restored power to its anti-aircraft guns, but could only delay the inevitable, as a fifth and final wave attacked at 12:41 and took three more torpedo strikes and began to capsize. Despite the damage, Prince of Wales stayed afloat long enough for the destroyer HMS Express to come alongside and assist taking off the crew that had gathered on the upper deck. She would sink stern first at 13:18, nearly taking the Express down with her as her hull scraped the destroyer. Admiral Phillips and his flag captain, Captain Jack Leach, went down with Prince of Wales, along with 327 officers and ratings of the complement of 1,612. For the loss of two British capital ships, the Japanese suffered four aircraft destroyed. As the ship slipped beneath the waves, 10 Buffalo fighters of No. 453 Squadron, Royal Australian Air Force, arrived and drove off the remaining Japanese planes, and then flew cover as the destroyers steamed in to rescue the wounded and stranded, as they had been largely ignored by the Japanese. Electra and Vampire steamed for the crew of Repulse, carefully picking through the oil and debris, while the Express stayed with the crew of Prince of Wales. As they were being rescued, survivors of Repulse manned action stations on the destroyers to free up more men for the rescue attempts. Once the three destroyers were fully laden, and with Electra as senior ship staying behind a further 3 hours to continue the search, they headed for Singapore. In doing so, they passed more warships from Singapore, which had steamed north once word was received of the attack, who took over the search for survivors, and sadly, there were no more found. The following day, one of the Japanese pilots flew to the site of the battle and dropped two wreaths in the sea to honour the combatants from both sides who had died in the battle. One was for these fellow members of his air group who had died, while the other was for the British sailors whose display of bravery in defence of the ships had garnered them the utmost admiration from the pilots of his squadron. The Prince of Wales and Repulse were the first capital ships actively defending themselves to be sunk solely by air power while steaming in the open sea. This attack sent shockwaves across the world. The age of the battleship was now over. Combined with the earlier raid on Pearl Harbor, this left the Allies with only three operational capital ships in the Pacific theater: the three aircraft carriers, USS Enterprise, Lexington, and Saratoga. Midshipman Robert Ian Davies' story, though, does not end with the sinking of Repulse. In 2011, it was announced that Davies' action on the 10th of December 1941 would be included into the inquiry into unresolved recognition for past acts of naval and military gallantry and valour, known colloquially as the Valour Inquiry or Valour Tribunal. The inquiry was conveyed following a question raised in the Australian Senate in 2010 asking why no member of the Royal Australian Navy had received the Victoria Cross, and included 13 men, most of whom were from the Navy. I've already covered two of these men already, Captain Hector McDonald Laws Waller and leading airman Noel Shipp, and I'll be working through the remainder throughout the year. Now, you're probably wondering, but Ross, you didn't actually mention what actions he did on the 10th of December during the battle. And well, that's because while there are many eyewitness accounts to the actions involving the sinking of Repulse and Prince of Wales, there is no direct eyewitness accounts of the specific actions of Davies. So then that raises the question, how did he get nominated for the tribunal? Davies' name was put forward by the then Chief of the Defence Force, Sir Angus Houston, with his family finding out about the inclusion when the list of the 14 nominees were published in the media. Now, there are only three primary sources that mention what Midshipman Davies did on the 10th of December. The first was Captain Tennant's recommendations for honours and awards to the Admiralty after the battle in which he recommended him for a posthumous mention in dispatches. The citation read, quote, "For great bravery and devotion to duty when HMS Repulse was sunk by Japanese aircraft on 10th of December 1941. At the time of her loss, this very gallant young officer was last seen firing an Oricon gun at enemy aircraft when he and the gun mounting was slowly submerging. Prior to this, he had shown himself an outstanding officer of quarters of close-range guns, 13th of October 1942," unquote. This was supported by Rear Admiral Guy Griffiths, who testified at the tribunal stating that, quote, "His duty at the gun was fire distribution officer, and he would have been tapping the aimer on the shoulder and pointing out another aircraft to engage. When he probably told his crew to abandon ship as they had been ordered to do so, then he strapped himself in and decided to have a crack himself. A pretty noble gesture and a brave one. Tragic," unquote. The other two sources were letters sent to Davies' mother by Captain Tennant and Assistant Navigator Lieutenant John Hayes, who was the officer responsible for training Davies while aboard Repulse, where they said that Davies, quote, "showed the very highest degree of bravery and leadership, which it is possible for an officer to show," unquote. The tribunal paid attention to the wording of Tennant's recommendation by listing 15 officers and sailors that he had recommended for awards and honours, of which Davies was listed third, and conversely, the only one who was commended for directly engaging with the Japanese. The rest were for self-sacrifice, assistance with the wounded, or efficiency in carrying out their duties. Interestingly, though, compared to the tribunal and his ship, most of the submissions put forward were in favour of Davies receiving a higher award, though not all agreed on what that award should be. However, the biggest obstacle in the tribunal was the lack of first-person accounts of his actions. Even Captain Tennant, Lieutenant Hayes, and Admiral Griffiths admitted they had heard of Davies' actions from others. Admiral Griffiths went on to point out that much like what I've raised with ship's episode, Davies' recommendation cannot be taken in isolation, and that upgrading his mentioned dispatches to a higher honour or reward would necessitate the other 15 honours also being reviewed, especially as he was listed third in the merit pool in Tennant's original recommendations. The other issue presenting the tribunal was the fact that while Davies was serving in the Royal Australian Navy, at the time of his death, he was serving aboard a Royal Navy capital ship attached to the Royal Navy, undertaking a Royal Navy operation, which meant that all nominations for honours would have gone through the Royal Navy chain and not through the Australian chain of command. The tribunal ruled that no further action be taken to award Midshipman Robert Ian Davies a Victoria Cross or any other form of higher recognition for his gallantry or valour over the posthumous mention of dispatches. Despite the support for this, the deciding factors for the tribunal were Captain Tennant's order of recommendations and the lack of direct eyewitnesses to his deed. After 50 episodes of I Was Only Doing My Job, Australia's Military History, I have come across a recurring theme, that of not wanting to let the men you serve with down. Now, we will never know the reasons why Midshipman Robert Davies did what he did. His diary and letters went down with Repulse. All we do have is second-hand accounts of respected officers of the Royal Navy and Royal Australian Navy. Now, while I agree with the findings of the Valor Tribunal in this instance, I do also point out that Davies must have done something worthy enough for others to speak highly of it, to the point that it reached the ears of the commanding officer of a Royal Navy battlecruiser, enough to recommend him for a higher award to begin with. At naval funerals, the naval ode is read which declares, "They have no grave but the cruel sea, no flowers lay at their head, a rusting hulk is their tombstone, a fast on the ocean bed." For Midshipman Davies, his tombstone and that of the other officers and sailors of Prince of Wales and Repulse was found after the war, Repulse in 56 metres of water and Prince of Wales in 68. As both ships capsized, they are nearly upside down. Divers attached buoys to the propeller shafts and a white ensign of the Royal Navy is attached to the line, which is routinely changed. As a tradition, any Royal Navy ship passing through the area performs a memorial service over the site of the wrecks. Sadly, those tombstones have also been disturbed, as illegal souveniring from shipwrecks is an unfortunate common pastime. The wreck site has been designated a protected place in 2002 under the Protection of Military Remains Act 1986 and are declared Crown property. As a result, Prince of Wales's bell was removed as a preventative from the wreck the same year by the Royal Navy over concerns it would be stolen. It is now on display at the Merseyside Maritime Museum in Liverpool. Despite both ships being declared Crown property and are protected places, in 2014 it was reported after a survey that both hulls had seen extensive damage due to explosives used by scrap metal dealers, something that since 2014 has become a serious issue in the South Pacific, with 40 vessels from the Second World War having been either partially or completely destroyed. This includes Captain Waller's HMAS Perth, of which 70% of the hull has been illegally removed from the seafloor. More recently, at the end of May 2023, a Chinese flag vessel, the Quan Hong 68, was detained by Malaysian authorities for illegally scavenging the wrecks of Prince of Wales and Repulse for its low background steel, a component of devices used to detect background radiation. As of time of recording, there are no further news on this. All I can say is I hope Davies has found peace somehow. And with that, folks, is the life, service, and legacy of Midshipman Robert Ian Davies. Despite his short life, he left an indelible mark on history. His unwavering dedication to duty, his willingness to serve, and his ultimate sacrifice are a testament to the resilience and courage displayed by countless individuals during times of war. Catch you next time, folks. Check back for next episode of the continuation of Shipwreck Summer. Works cited in this episode are the Royal Australian Naval College magazines from 1937 to 1947, the report of the Inquiry into Unresolved Recognition for Past Acts of Naval and Military Gallantry and Valour, 2010, Guy Griffiths, The Life and Times of an Australian Admiral, the service record of Midshipman Robert Ian Davies, Australia in the War of 1939-1945, Series 2, Navy, Australian Dictionary of Biographies, Volume 13, entry on Robert Ian Davies, the Royal Australian Naval website's biography on Midshipman Robert Ian Davies, the website of Navy Victoria Network, the Forgotten Campaign, the Dutch East Indies Campaign of 1941-1942 website, Battleship, the Sinking of Prince of Wales and Repulse by Martin Middlebrook and Patrick Mahoney, the World's Biggest Grave Robbery, Asia's Disappearing World War II Shipwrecks by Olivia Holmes, Monica Ulmalu, and Simon Roberts, and the website of the Australian War Memorial. Thanks for listening to the I Was Only Doing My Job Australia's Military History Podcast, a Doc Network production. This episode was recorded on the lands of the Gangdangara people, whose elders have passed on knowledge for thousands of years, and we pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. This episode was written, researched, produced, directed, and audio engineered by me, Ross, with additional research done by Laurie Favell of My Silent Hero. If you do know someone whose story needs to be told, feel free to leave a comment on an episode or send us an email at iwasonlydoingmyjobpod@gmail.com. If you like what we do here and you want to support this podcast, the best thing you can do is share this with a friend or leave a review on your favorite podcast platform, as it really helps others find the show. And if you want to join in on the conversation, join us over on Discord. And if you want more content, including show notes, photos, transcripts, and my various adventures finding memorials dotted around Australia, head over to our website at www.thedocnetwork.net and follow the show on all our social media pages at IWODMJ. Don't worry, there are links to everything in the show notes. Join me personally for more bite-sized history over on TikTok and pretty much everywhere else at Doc Winters. All opinions expressed in this episode are solely those of the speaker and do not reflect the views or opinions of any entity, agency, or organization. It is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike 4.0 International License. Thanks for listening. Catch you next time. Bye.